but we're just doing review at this point. And I understand that Commissioner Mossman is running late. So, Mr. Kerr, can you come in first, please? And once we get a quorum, I'm going to interrupt you and get all of our regular business taken care of. But if you could start us off, Mr. Kerr, state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs, and I'm here today to present our portion of House File 1080, the appropriations bill for the 1819 biennium. We did provide a handout to the committee in advance, and really what this does is breaks down what the different programs that are impacted by our request for an increase, and there are really, I believe, two requests for increase to the 1819 budget. The first one that I'll talk about has to do with an increase in the incentives appropriation of $11.536 million for the biennium. And that program funds mostly our state tuition reimbursement program, our state reenlistment bonus program to a smaller extent, the state medic bonus program to a smaller extent, our state enlistment bonus program to a smaller extent, and a very small extent, our state reclassification bonus program. And, Madam Chair, that is an appropriation that we asked the legislature to actually reduce moving forward from its previous level. We formally got just over $10 million annually, so about $20 million for the biennium. We were forecasting what the use of that was going to be, and we're actually carrying forward quite a healthy balance. And if you'll recall, asked to move $10 million in cash one time from that appropriation to the maintenance appropriation, and then reduce the ongoing appropriation into the future. Our intention was to actually overspend to drive down the balance we were carrying forward and try to come in at the end of this upcoming biennium with an adjustment slightly up. A couple of things changed, though, Madam Chair, that threw our math off, and we are going through that money a lot faster than we originally expected and are at a situation where instead of bringing it close to zero by the end of the next biennium, are going to bring it to zero here in June of this year. And so there's a separate initiative that we're bringing forward to fix a problem for 17, but are looking at this adjustment for the 18-19 biennium.
And, Mr. Kerr, I'm going to pause you right there because, first off, let's see, do we have quorum? Not yet. I just wanted to ask you about that piece in particular because I understand that the feds had suspended their tuition program prior to us making the change, and then that resulted in more people utilizing the state version of it. Is that correct? Can you kind of walk us through that piece in particular?
Yes, Madam Chair. They didn't actually suspend the program, but they changed the rule set that restricted the eligibility of many of our service members and delayed their eligibility in most cases for up to 3 years, effectively removing them from eligibility for the program. That did put more pressure on our state tuition reimbursement program because we previously required everyone to apply for federal tuition assistance before they applied for the state tuition reimbursement using the federal dollars first, and we don't double pay them. But we lost that opportunity, made a rule change that because no one was being eligible for it, we actually even lifted the requirement to first apply for FTA. We are actually reinstituting our role to first apply for FTA, and Madam Chair, we are operating in a parallel universe here with the feds, trying to put pressure on the Department of the Army and using our CODEL to try to drive a rule change back the other direction that will open that eligibility for our service members back up, that will allow us to push back more money out of FTA and put less pressure on the state tuition reimbursement program in the future.
And Mr. Kerr, where are you at in that status, and you know, what would the timeline be if they were to change that?
Madam Chair, we could expect a change as early as July. The things that are moving in our favor are the dramatic shift in the pendulum or swing in the pendulum after the election and the new administration taking their seat. We are already getting indicators, even though they don't yet have the authority to do so, that the Army is intending to put a lot of resources toward recruiting and retaining our service members. And this is one of those programs that we think will have funds available to it on the federal side and should not be a big problem convincing the Army to change its eligibility back as part of its overall incentive program. So that could happen as early as July of this year, though it could also take much longer than that. It could take another year after that. It's really hard to tell. Part of that is because it gets tied up in authorities of the continuing resolution in some cases. Most of this is internal policy in the Army, though, so that really shouldn't be a factor, although the availability of federal funding and the appropriation of federal funding may affect it to a certain extent.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That I appreciate you giving that additional information. If you want to keep going, I know you had some other ones.
All right, Madam Chair, the other operating budget increase that we have listed, that's $178,000 over the biennium. That is basically calculated at 1% of our personnel costs and 1.8% of our personnel costs for the first and second year of the biennium combined, and then you'll see those broken up in the spreadsheet, actually, some inside the maintenance appropriation, some of the general support appropriation, and a very small amount in the listed incentives appropriation. And that's specifically there to cover the increased cost forecast for the contracts that have already been negotiated and the known cost increases and the estimated increase in costs in insurance coverage or insurance premiums paid by the employer.
Okay. Members, any questions at all at this point? Let's talk a little bit more about the enlistment piece. Are you going to give us greater detail on that, please?
All right, Madam Chair. So I did actually put a couple of charts in the presentation. The first one, blue over red line that you should see, and it's a pretty graphic depiction of what happened. The federal tuition assistance made the big turn in FY13, and the eligibility dropped off, and you can see our utilization of federal funding dropped commensurately with the increase in our state tuition reimbursement requirement. But when you go to the next chart, which should be an orange and blue column, you'll see that as the incentives increases went up, although it's true that FTA decreased, our actual utilization of the state tuition reimbursement program exceeded the diminishment in the FTA availability. So we had a couple of things happen to us. We were forecasting a reduction in the number of our service members that would be going into college, and that forecast was basically tied to a fairly common idea that when the economy improves, fewer people go back to school, and that is true in the general population in Minnesota, hence the decreased enrollment in Minnesota state schools and in the University of Minnesota. But for some reason, our population is actually attending college at a higher rate than they were, and that's what that next chart. You can see that the number of users of our program, and this is a blue and green bar chart on the bottom of what should be the second page of your handout, shows. And the green line is the number of users that we have in our program, and you see that increase from approximately 1,700 up to nearly 1,900 from 2012 to 2016. The payment indication is that we have more of our service members who are actually going into college and staying in college. So that's where the discrepancy between the number of users and the number of payments. The number of payments has increased because we have users who are going to more than one semester of college and seeking that payment in a year.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I just wonder if you could kind of, ours are black and white, so if you could just kind of, say, like left, right, middle.
The column on the left is users, and the column on the right are the number of payments.
Okay. As members are absorbing that, I am going to call State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, in your packets, you have the minutes from March 8th. If Representative Vogel wants to move the minutes. Representative Vogel moves the minutes for March 8th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are adopted. Okay, members, any further questions so we all understand the request from Military Affairs? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably going to sound foolish to some of you, but I'm just wondering, you've got, it looks like approximately 3,300 payments. What's the dollar attached to that? Is that, am I missing that?
Mr. Green.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have the exact dollar amount. Let's see if I can dig that up. I may phone my friend, Mr. LaBelle.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, CW3 LaBelle, Department Comptroller.
Okay.
We're looking at the total amount of payments. I think total amount of payments out of STR we're giving here. That's it. What's the dollar value? I think we're looking total.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, were you looking for the total amount expended in the year in STR and state tuition reimbursement? Is that what you're looking for?
Madam Chair, well, yeah, you've got the graph here, and so we've got 1,700 enrolled up from, you said, 1,500, I think. And so you've got 200 more users, and yet it looks like there's quite a few more payments. So what is the discrepancy between, or the difference between the 2015 and the 2016 in the way of dollars?
Mr. Kirk?
Madam Chair, Representative Green, so what happens is, as our soldiers enroll in school, they complete a semester, request their payment, they get paid. If they enroll in a second semester in the same year, the user doesn't get counted again, but he does get another payment. Does that make sense? So if a typical college student were going to school for two semesters a year, we would expect the number of payments to be exactly double the number of students. But in some cases, we have service members that only go for a single semester a year or a summer session or something like that.
Representative Green?
Okay, I guess I get that now, why there was a difference in the bar chart as far as them being equal. But then if you could just let me know what the payments were. I don't, I guess, need to know it right now. But the total number for the dollars in 2016.
Yeah, I'm sure we actually have a chart that lays that out, and we'll provide that to the committee if that meets the bill.
That would be helpful. Thank you. Appreciate that. Members, any other questions for Mr. Kerr? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Next on deck, Mr. Johnson. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I'm the Legislative Director of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm joined today by our Financial Director, John Powers.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're here today to address the Governor's recommendations for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs for the 2018-19 biennium. We have I've highlighted the three change items in the handout submitted to the committee, items 1, 2, and 3. I'd like to go through those, and I'm happy to answer any questions as we proceed.
Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
First on the list in the handout is the Minnesota Veterans Cemetery in Duluth. This is a cemetery that was authorized in statute, and we submitted an application for construction to the federal VA, received a grant last fall, and began construction, expected to open in summer of 2018. In the meantime, we are here to request $500,000 per fiscal year 18 and additionally in 19, and then going forward to support the operations, salary, and benefits of that new cemetery. The total ask is includes both the FTEs ongoing. Initially, in 18, we don't expect to have a full contingent of staff, as it won't be needed, but we will be using that request to offset costs that aren't covered by the federal grant allocation for the construction and purchase of items needed for the continuing operation. The goal is eventually to have four state veteran cemeteries. Currently, we have Little Falls is open, Preston is open, Duluth will be opening in 2018, and the legislature has authorized and directed us to pursue a cemetery in Redwood County so that all four corners of the state are covered by a state veteran cemetery. The second item on our list of change items requested is funding for repair and betterment. This is a one-time appropriation, fiscal year 2018, of $2 million. MDVA owns or operates more than 50 buildings statewide. Replacement value is $265 million or thereabouts. State statute suggests a 1% R&B allocation for per the replacement value. In working with the governor's office to develop our request, we were advised, with regards to the best practices, that we do the $2 million to offset the expenditures and hopefully an asset preservation capital investment bill will be forthcoming to address some of our long-term maintenance needs. The challenge that we face with the with repair and betterment is that this is the last item on the list, so to speak. When we receive our operating budget, we pay our obligations in the form of daily operations and administration of our five state veterans' homes. R&B is the last pool of money. So as in the past, it has not been a specific line item. But at this juncture, seeing as that we have not received any additional asset preservation funds since fiscal year 2014, we're hoping to include it in the budget request so that we can begin to address some of our highest need repairs. Third item on the list today is the Minnesota GI Bill. This is a program that's been in existence for a number of years. It's in addition to the federal post 9/11 GI Bill. It's a $10,000 lifetime limit for Minnesota veterans and some eligible dependents to access additional monies to complete their college education. In addition to that, the agency has found it beneficial to include apprenticeship and on-the-job training programs in addition to the higher education. So the first portion of this is to expand the OJT and apprenticeship to add an additional fund of $200,000 in fiscal year 2018 and 2019, and then ongoing. This would more accurately align the OJT and apprenticeship program with the higher education program. Currently, those pursuing OJT and apprenticeship have the law as written dictates results in them receiving a smaller amount of money in terms of what's allowed per year. The other portion of this is permissible uses is an expansion of permitted uses so that veteran students would be able to use Minnesota GI Bill to pay for things like tests, licenses, and certifications. The reason that we've included this and feel that it's important is that at present the post 9/11 federal benefits allow service members and veterans to use money to pay for these items. However, it results in the use of an entire month's worth of benefit at the federal level. And this is a significant disincentive for veterans because a full month of post 9/11 benefits is a significant chunk of money. It's not a set amount per individual, but would be significantly more than the cost of a test. So we would like to be able to target the value or the amount of a test to continue with a professional career or, for instance, nursing licensure or certification for the things such as accounting or whatnot, that we would allow them to take a targeted amount from their lifetime benefit to use to pursue testing. And we estimate that this will be welcomed and utilized. We've seen significant increases in the Minnesota GI Bill as our service members have ramped down and come home to Minnesota and are pursuing education to further their careers. It was addressed by MMB in committee last week, but if you turn the page over in the handout, you can see a breakdown of the governor's recommendations, including our base requests, and included in the agency change items is the operating adjustment that that Commissioner Franz addressed, and this is something that was recommended to us in sort of consult with the governor's office in understanding the costs associated with upcoming changes in salary and benefits per the collective bargaining agreements that are in place. So if you look at the right-hand side, for programs and services, we're looking at a change in the base funding of about 4.26%. Just over 3% of that is for the funding for the Duluth Cemetery. 0.92% of that is the operating adjustment request, and then the repair and betterment portion of the ask is about 0.3%. Follow that column down. Veterans Healthcare is looking at about a 3.3% change in base funding. 1.66% of that is is for the R&B of the homes and a 1.71% increase in the base for the operating adjustment. I'm happy to answer any questions you or the committee might have. Thank you.
Oh, I've got to start off. I'm interested in your Veterans Cemetery proposal. You've got 7.5 FTEs, and when I look at the budget data, it doesn't explain what those would be for. Can you give greater detail on what those would be for?
Certainly. So each of our existing cemeteries have FTEs. It includes the cemetery administrator and office and administrative staff member, and then there are additional positions such as groundskeepers, maintenance technicians, and others. I'd like to ask Mr. Powers if he could tell us the some of the other individuals who, if you know, you know.
Mr. Powers.
Madam Chair, committee members. Like Mr. Ben said here, it's primarily, you know, mowers, people that upkeep the place, and excavate, prepare the crypts and whatnot for burials.
Okay, here's what would be helpful for us. I would like you to provide me an itemization of the 7.5 FTEs and what they would do, what their hours of work requirement are for each of those individuals, and then what you expect the cost for each one of those FTEs to be. Okay? And then I'd also like it for the other facilities, the Little Falls, for Preston, and then, of course, the Stiller Farm. Okay?
We'll provide you that.
And then, members, I would also like, well, and we've got some questions. I'll go to that first. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, the federal grant of $8.34 million, do you have that in hand now, or do you need the $1 million from the state to put that in effect with respect to the Duluth Cemetery situation?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we have received that funding. That funding was contingent on the state of Minnesota funding the ongoing operations of that facility. So the money is in hand, and construction has begun at the cemetery. It's just west of Duluth off of Highway 53. So that money has been received and is being expended in the process of constructing that cemetery.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on the repair and betterment funding, I see you're requesting $2 million for some of your buildings statewide. What is the, I forget the name of the guy next to you there, but what if you don't get the $2 million to do the repair, what do you estimate in general sense, formulaic, the cost will be the next time around, the next biennium, if we just continue to let it ride?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, in terms of continued cost increases for repairs delayed, I don't have a specific number. I can tell you that the asset preservation request that we included in the capital bonding projects for last year, we identified $11.2 million worth of items of repair, systems or otherwise, that with regards to the facilities conditions audits that the state uses to address its facilities, are ones and twos, which are failing or critical items. And the longer we delay on maintenance or repairs in any of these, the greater the need to address. As it stands, we have more than $11 million worth of projects that are critical in a position where they could be failing in the near future. So I hope that answers your question. I could certainly get an estimate for how much more it will cost.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just follow up then. So how come you didn't request $11 million then, if that's your need?
Certainly.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, what we were asked to do was to prioritize in terms of, I'm sure that you're aware there was, I think, $4 plus billion worth of projects submitted. And in keeping with the governor's promise to be fiscally prudent about what sorts of things we were asked to prioritize and identified approximately 20 projects that were sort of in the direst need, and that was what was included in his recommendation. Identifying the $11 million is simply our way of saying we are trying to be prudent and responsible with the funds that we're requesting and making sure that we're only addressing those that are most critical at this juncture.
Representative Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the reserve balance and the legislative auditor's report on that. So what do you have the reserve balance at now, Mr. Powers? And if you could please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is John Powers. I'm the finance director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Currently, right now, when I loaded the biennial budget, as you might be aware of, but we're asked to load that budget at the early part of the fiscal year, which would have been in September or October of last year. And at that time, we estimated that we would have a reserve fund balance of $10.5 million at the end of this fiscal year. However, that number, because of the uncertainty of our revenues at this time right now, current quarterly projections, we just finished our second quarter projection, and right now that number is right around $9 to $9.5 million that we expect to have at the end of this fiscal year.
And Mr. Powers, can you explain why there was an error last year when you told us that there was not any reserve?
Madam Chair, part of the calculation was wrong. I think we addressed it at our last hearing, where Minute had overestimated what they were going to expend in fiscal year 15, along with a couple of the other homes had overestimated what they thought they were going to spend in salaries. And so as a result, initially we estimated that the ending balance would be $3.5 million at the end of FY15. And so the difference there being those two items, which is why that ending balance of FY15 ended up approximately to be about $9 million.
Mr. Powers, you said that the some of the homes had overestimated their salaries. Can you tell me how that came to be?
Madam Chair, my name is Mike McKelly. I'm the Chief of Staff for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And I just want to remind the committee, if I could take us back and provide a little context. We're approaching our 10th year, our decade mark, if you will, from when Governor Polenity put the homes back under the purview of MDVA. And in those 10 years, we've reconstructed a lot of the homes. We've been mandated to undergo the CMS process so that we can provide better care for our veterans. And that is what we have done. And in that process, we have fixed many areas within the homes the way the old business was done. And I wasn't necessarily here for the way the old business was done, but I can tell you we have implemented many changes relative to finance, relative to management, relative to staffing, and there are a plethora of issues that we have to deal with on a daily basis for those homes. So I just want to provide the context that we have been in an uphill change process, if you will, for the last decade. I don't know that all the members are aware of that, Madam Chair, and as I look around the committee, I've seen there's a few members that have actually been to those homes to kind of see what happens on a daily basis. So I know Representative Detmer is there quite often, and he could probably provide just as good a witness of the changes that have occurred over the last 10 years. So I apologize that I have to kind of bring that up, Madam Chair, but I feel like oftentimes the context of the homes is not really well known of where we were and where we are today.
Mr. Powers, can you help me understand why they overestimated the salaries portion from the veteran homes?
Madam Chair, committee members, at that time we were instituting a new sort of central reporting, if you will, and there was some misunderstanding of how they should report. Currently, right now, we estimate when we have our quarterly projection meetings with each of the homes, it's their responsibility to estimate what they think they're going to spend totally for the year for salaries and non-salaries. And at that time, there was a couple of the business managers within the homes that were actually using the dollar amount that they were budgeted for rather than what they thought that they were actually going to spend. And it didn't become clear to us until after the session was over and when the actual fiscal year closed out that that became apparent that that's what happened.
So, Mr. Powers, when you're talking about the salaries, did they, you know, not have as many FTEs? Or I just help me understand that a little bit more. And do you have maybe the people from the veterans' homes that provided you with these numbers? They could walk through that. Are any of them here?
Madam Chair, no, none of them are here. Again, we were instituting a new reporting method is what we were doing, and they misunderstood what they were being asked to provide. And so typically, you know, if they have additional revenues that they would bring in during the year, they may house those within those salary budgets. And so rather than them telling me what they were actually going to spend in the given year, in their third quarter projections, what they were actually doing was providing me what they actually had budgeted within there.
Okay. And why did they have it as this is what they were planning to budget for? Did they leave positions open, or what was the, why was there a discrepancy between actual and the budgeting piece?
Madam Chair, again, it, because our revenues are uncertain, when those funds come in, they're put into accounts, okay? And typically they'll, depending on the projections within Semaphore, will indicate what they're going to need for the year. Within that projection, though, is typically vacancies, and we have record numbers of vacancies within each of the homes, and so that it will project out that, you know, 10 vacancies, I'm going to need an additional $500,000. And so that's what they typically were using to budget for. But as the year progresses, that number should go down, but they wouldn't necessarily change that budget amount.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, if I may, one thing, too, I understand there's a variety of education and understanding of the long-term health care processes here. And with MDVA, we are not unlike many of the other long-term care facilities in the state. We're undergoing a massive shortage of staff. And so one of the reasons, we will always have vacancies, and that's something that we're trying to work out. CMS has caused us to do business a lot different. You know, one of the things that I was just reading the other day under CMS is the goal for long-term care facilities by 2018 is to reduce the turnover rate down to a minimal 40% turnover annually. Almost half the staff turning over annually is a good goal, apparently, according to CMS. So we're facing healthcare shortages. My wife happens to work in the healthcare industry. And frankly, I can tell you there is more demand than there are supply, as you probably well know. And these healthcare providers can actually walk around with their resignations on their devices so that if one day they walk into a home or a facility or a hospital and they don't want to work in there, work there anymore, they could just hit the send button and they can go across the street and get another job. So that's one of the challenges we face. It's a shortage across the state, across the nation, and we know we have areas to work on. But when we talk about staffing, that's something that the commissioner has been working very hard to address, and our new deputy commissioner, Doug Hughes, is also here. We're required, the standard that exists out there is a five-star rating, and what that really does is it measures a couple of categories, one of which is staffing. And the amount of hours staffed per resident, per home, is how this rating is determined. There's a calculus in there. But the bottom line is if we are, our goal is to meet the five-star rating. And if we don't meet the five-star rating, what that actually means and translates it to is somebody is waiting longer for assistance. Somebody might be bleeding. Somebody's IV may have come undone. Somebody might be sitting in their own urine or their own feces for a longer period of time because we don't have the staff on hand at our homes. And the commissioner is not willing to do that. And I can tell you, Madam Chair, as someone who's laid in their own blood in a foreign land and talks to those veterans in the homes that saved the world, as many of our congressional members introduce themselves and talk to them, they say, oh, you're part of that crew that actually saved the world. Well, I've laid in my own blood, and I've waited, and I've had my tongue so swollen that I was screaming for help while I was laying in a hospital, and we are not going to let that happen to our residents and our heroes in these veterans' homes. And the commissioner has made it very clear that we're not going to let that happen. So, Madam Chair, I apologize. We have some issues that we're working on. Staffing is one of them. And I'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Powers, can you walk through the vacancy rates that you have in each of the homes again for me, please?
Madam Chair, I don't have that information with me. We can certainly get that for you.
Can you give me a ballpark figure? I know you mentioned it earlier in testimony that you had some vacancy rates issues in some of the homes. Can you give me an idea of which homes have vacancies? Mr. Johnson, could you help out, please?
I'm sorry, I don't right off the top of
Looks
my head.
Looks like you got somebody to come down to help.
Okay. My name is Douglas Hughes, Deputy Commissioner of Healthcare, MDVA, Madam Chair, Representatives. We approximately have 10 to 15% of shortages, which does a few different things. It causes, as Mr. McKelvey pointed out, the wait times, that sort of thing. But what it also causes is mandation and overtime. So if you have an employee who is, we don't have that employee in that position, what causes it is that you have for volunteers for overtime, which is time and a half at least, or you mandate, which is saying you must stay. You can't go home. You will work another shift. And so that's one of the causes of our high overtime and our high salary costs. For example, up in Silver Bay, we have approximately 22 HSTs or certified nurse assistant openings. We have a number of RN and LPN openings. So depending on the home, it can be great, which is causing us a lot of problems.
Okay. I think it would just be helpful if you can provide that data to us for each of the homes. It would be good for us to take a review of that. And I think at a later time, we will have the legislative auditor to come over and review. His report is of concern to me, especially when it comes to the reserve amount and the fact that we were told that you guys didn't have any reserve. The exact words were had exhausted your reserves, and then we still found out later on that there was over $9 million in reserves. And very frustrating from a legislative perspective when the day that we're on the House floor with the state government finance bill, we get this urgent request for more funds, which in effect were not needed at all. And I think that's a disservice to our veterans and to the people of Minnesota. We do have Representative Nash has a question, and then after that we are going to delay the rest of review till a later date when we'll have the legislative auditor come in and talk about some of these issues. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I got $2 for anybody who guesses where I'm going to go. Mr. Powers, you'd said something along the lines of discrepancy with your minute spend. Can you detail that for us again? Because when we were here last time, you didn't have a lot of information. You said you were going to go back and get some more information, and I'm hoping that you brought it with you.
Mr. Powers?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Anyone?
Mr. McKelly?
Again, I just want to provide some context again, because I know we've had a minute in here testifying before your committee as well. And so as I talk about this transition that we've been under for the last, you know, roughly decade now, one of the things that I find interesting, and I'm not an acquisition and mergers attorney or any of that, but from what I understand what is supposed to occur with acquisitions and mergers, there's some kind of calculus that tells you you're going to have some money left over to do some things to actually merge. And one of the things that MDVA was benefited from was a one-time $100,000 appropriation to combine our IT services within the five-state veterans' homes and the organization we the programs and services. And again, I'm not an IT expert, but that was not a lot of money. So the context I guess I want to provide is we have been working for years to get our IT infrastructure in place. And so as we talk and deal with Minute and IT, we've got more projects in the hopper than that they can handle. They don't have the capacity to do them all. And so I just want that context to kind of be understood, and then I'll turn it over to John.
Mr. Power.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash. This was another process during that time. Mind you, Minute was consolidating at that time, too, and the actual communication and reporting and the information that I was getting at that time indicated that in that third quarter of FY15, they were going to spend an additional $2 million between that time and the end of the year, and that didn't occur for whatever reason. Mr. McKelleny actually pointed out that we did receive additional funding, I believe, in FY12 or 13 to upgrade our infrastructure. And so there's an appropriation that sits over on the Minute side that our Minute staff uses to make improvements to our area. But we have both that and then what they actually charge us. So they could be using that. They could have thought that it was that that they were going to use the funds that were being retained in their account rather than what they were going to actually charge us. At this point right now, I can't tell you, it's over 2 years ago exactly what happened. Since then, I can tell you that we meet on a regular basis to go over what they think they're going to spend during any given year. It's difficult, too, to actually determine that, not knowing what they can get done in any given year. For instance, last year, at the beginning of this year, they had over $2 million worth of projects on the books that we needed to get done, and talking it through with them, realistically speaking, they thought they'd maybe be able to get $1 million worth of projects done. And so it's difficult at that time, even at the beginning of the year, to know what they're actually going to get done.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when you were here last, we had asked for this information. You said you would go back and try to work it out, and when we came back, you would have it for us. And were you able to go back and do any of that, or that? I thought that was a takeaway that you were going to get back to us on.
Mr. Powers?
Madam Chair, we provided you a letter on February 8th of 2017, kind of going through what I thought were all the questions that you had. I don't know, Representative Nash, if you got an opportunity to read that.
Maybe you could walk through that, Mr. Powers, so that we can see if it's covered all the questions that Representative Nash has.
Madam Chair, committee members, the first question you had was, why do we make a transfer to the governor's office, and how is that calculated? And that's an interagency agreement. The total contribution was $16,500. Contributions are based on a number of factors, including the size of the agency, time spent on agency-related issues, federal dollars received, and previous contributions. What was the transfer to MMD for Better Government Initiative?
Maybe what you could do is on the question of the minute piece, Mr. Powers.
And Madam Chair, and Representative Nash, it might be helpful if you repeated your question so we know where to find it on the document.
Well, in your
Representative
Madam
Nash.
Chair, thank you. In your opening testimony just a few seconds ago, you talked about that there was a discrepancy with minute. And that was my question, is articulate the discrepancy. And we've got minute here. Maybe we should just have them come down and help us.
Before we do that, Mr. Powers, in the letter that you provided as a response to February 8th, I remember Representative Nash asking that as a question. Do you have the response as part of your February 8th letter to us?
Madam Chair, yes, I do. The answer to your question, what was the discrepancy or dollar amount that Minute said they were going to spend before the end of the year? And I stated, I misunderstood the question that you asked me, Madam Chair, at the time of the hearing when I replied it was $5.3 million. This was an inaccurate statement. Prior to this question, I had testified that the $5.3 million was a dollar understatement of the reserve funds resulted from a combination of approximately $2 million that Minute projected to be spent and more than $2 million in veteran home salary expenditures.
Representative Nash.
Well, maybe we just get Minute to come down and help clarify, because I'm still not sure. You referenced this discrepancy, and you said that it was something that you should have paid, you should have gotten, or you didn't get. And I'm just trying to figure out, based on your testimony, what are we talking about still?
Does Minute want to provide clarification? It sounds like Mr. Powers says that he erroneously provided the amount of 5.3, and it was more 2 million, correct?
Correct.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, for the record, Jesse Oman with Minnesota IT Services. Mr. Powers is correct. It was about $2 million from Minute, and it was really a result of staff that we were not able to find or hire. Now, that year there had been additional appropriation, and I just got a note about it. A little over $1 million to be able to do more IT work with MDVA. We did fill 8 positions, but there were some we didn't be able to fill. Now, again, that is a chargeback model that we have, so it would have been a budgeted amount to be able to do, and that's an amount that we weren't able to fill. Now, I will say, just kind of going forward on this, we've been able to do a much more historical modeling of what do we traditionally spend, how much project work can we get done. Project work is always a combination of business availability and IT availability, being able to marry up and do that. And going forward, we've actually reduced that local IT budget by around $1.4 million because we continue to see this challenge where we're never spending to that projected amount. So I know going forward, we've actually lowered that down to be more in line with what we're actually seeing as a true spend.
Representative Nash.
And Madam Chair, I don't want to drag this on, so maybe we can, I think maybe we should reformulate a letter and get some answers, because I'm still confused as to where that money is or isn't. So if we could just.
Okay. Madam Chair.
And Mr. Powers.
Representative Nash, that money is in the reserve. It would have been carried over from 15 to 16.
We'll walk through it, and we'll get through that piece.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay.
And Mr. McKelly, can you come back, please? Thank you, Mr. Ullman. You provided in your explanation or your background that you provided, you've talked about that this has been a transition, a 10-year transition. Can you tell me the timeline of completing the transition for this whole process? Have you mapped that out? Do you have an end date of where this will no longer be a decade-long transition and it'll be complete?
Well, Madam Chair, I think as far as the construction goes, I believe 2018 is when we expect the Building 22 on Minneapolis to be.
Understand me. I think when we're talking about transition, you've been talking about the operation side of it and managing the homes themselves. So in that 10-year transition of the homes itself, can you tell me what's the kind of the timeline of being complete, of taking over this responsibility, and where you think you'll be at for that?
Madam Chair, I guess I would argue that the transition continuously occurs. Just this afternoon, I was reading 17 more regulations that just passed from CMS that we have to develop policies on, that we have to analyze. Doug, the deputy might be able to provide a better explanation. But this is something that is ongoing. We don't just get to a sort of a goalpost and call the game. I mean, there are things we're inspected by VA, by federal inspectors, by the Department of Health, and as you well know, laws change every year. So we don't know when we're going to be done. All we know is we have to provide the best care possible to the residents in our homes. As far as the construction goes, 2018 it will be complete. As far as finances and management go, every day we look for the margins that we are not capturing. Every day we work to get to the mandate that the legislature has put upon us, which is to maximize CMS reimbursements. Every day we look at the staff and the manning that we have and consider whether it's the right staff and the right manning for the job that day, that year, that next year. So I guess to answer your question, Madam Chair, I mean,
I think what will be helpful for us is for you to give us kind of your roadmap overall. I'm assuming that you've done some strategic planning of when you hope to accomplish each of these goals. And we can talk about that at a later time, probably when we have the legislative auditor come in, because I just think that that would be helpful for us to know, because we're concerned about that overall operation and management of the homes. Okay?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and we welcome the audit.
Great. Thank you. We are going to have Commissioner Mossman up, if you want to come up, please. Welcome to the committee. I owe you a telephone call. I'll get to it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No worries. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Matt Mossman, Commissioner of Administration. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon and present Governor Dayton's budget recommendations for the Department of Administration. As a refresher to the department overview I presented to this committee in January, roughly 11% of admin's total budget comes from the general fund. Nearly half of that is pass-through funds, such as public broadcasting grants that we administer. Admin employs about 470 people, compared to over 500 in 2009. These employees are passionate about their work and dedicated to providing the best possible outcomes for Minnesotans. Most of the resources we use to perform our responsibilities comes from chargebacks to other agencies, such as for space leases, vehicle leases, insurance coverage, and other internal service functions. That said, while our direct customers are primarily other state agencies, vendors, the legislature and courts, media, and nearly 300,000 school children and visitors to the state capitol annually, we also directly serve Minnesotans in each of your districts through various programs that we administer, including services provided by the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, assistive technology services, demographic services, data practices, and working with small businesses owned by veterans, minority, women, disabled individuals, and all small businesses that are interested in pursuing state contracts, as well as oversight of construction projects statewide and state property leases. In January, I also highlighted areas of cost savings efficiencies that are the result of my team's continuous efforts to find innovative ways to solve problems, deliver services, and I can certainly recap those efficiencies for the committee as we go through. To build on our strengths, though, and to continue supporting a well-functioning state government, Governor Dayton has recommended two budget initiatives for admin in addition to funding essential operating budget adjustments. One is a modern e-procurement system, and secondly, funding to support a full 2020 census count for Minnesota and related demographic services. I'll take more time to talk about those recommendations in a moment, but first I want to underscore the importance of the general fund operating budget adjustment and the in-lieu of rent appropriation increase, which is also related to operations. To perform admin statutory responsibilities, we compete with other employers for work talent. We are expected to continuously innovate and maintain modern, intuitive technologies used by our vendors, parkers, business customers, and others. And we're expected to secure, protect, and properly use vendor, employee, and citizen data. Costs for worker talent, pension and benefits, rent, utilities, technology, and other operations increase over time, and those costs have been increasing. Skilled tradespeople in particular is just one example of where we have difficulty attracting and retaining talent because we are not at competitive salaries with the private sector. The ongoing general fund operation budget adjustment of $847,000 a year is needed to continue a variety of functions, including protecting taxpayers' interests through our oversight of state contracts in ways that result in negotiated contract savings, reduce the state's financial risk, promote equity, minimize state litigation, and ensure best value. Just over the past 2 years alone, our staff has helped to negotiate $32 million in cost avoidance by negotiating lower prices with vendors. And we need the funds to help ensure that we can continue taxpayer-funded building projects meet the needs of Minnesotans once construction is complete through the oversight of our state construction contracts and space leases. And we need to use the resources to complete the work performed by our team to restore, the work of that team has helped to restore the historic masterpiece across the street, to provide rapid and clean up and repairs to the building that we're in right now after extensive water damage occurred this summer. They help minimize the need for costly consulting contracts for capital investment projects. And our construction and real estate team has partnered with the Department of Veterans Affairs to create a place of honor where veterans in southeastern Minnesota could be laid to rest in the Minnesota State Veterans Cemetery in Preston. Operating cost adjustments are also important so that we can retain already diminished data practices, assistance to state agencies, the media, and Minnesotans statewide, as well as demographic services, continuous improvement leadership, just to name a few functions that are supported by our general fund operations. I believe that failing to fund the governor's budget recommendations will result in state government that is less efficient, less transparent, and less accessible to small businesses wanting to compete for state contracts. Let me give a few quick examples of how efficiency could be impacted by inadequate funding. You all may recall that in 2014, Minnesota had a fairly harsh winter. It depleted, of all things important to Minnesota, road salt stores used by the Department of Transportation as well as local governments in your communities across the state. And as a result, we headed into 2015 with a situation where not just in Minnesota, but many states and local communities across the country faced depleted road salt stores. Our contracting staff was ahead of the game, was able to identify that this was going to be an emerging market issue, engaged vendors and entered into contracts early in 2015, was able to ensure supplies of important road salt needs for both the state and for local communities across Minnesota prior to those costs skyrocketing and, frankly, not even being able to get a hold of road salt when the 2015 winter season came around. We also have been effective at leading energy conservation building projects that help us avoid about $2 million in utility costs annually across the campus, and an internal financial consolidation that we prioritized over the last couple years has been able to convert parts of 33 different people's positions, or the equivalent of about 13 FTE, into a more effective team of 11 people centrally located to provide financial services. But also, we do things like that to help reallocate and make sure that we can be meeting needs like when I arrived as commissioner, we have a responsibility under statute to support emergency planning activities for the state of Minnesota, but we did not have a person with the skills or the time to do that. And now, as a result of efficiencies and reallocating them, we have that position in place. The same is true, Madam Chair and members, for the in lieu of rent appropriation. The in lieu of rent appropriation is used to pay operating costs of the Capitol, the legislative office space in this building, and space assigned to veterans organizations and services for the blind across the Capitol complex. The $1.2 million annual increase for in lieu of rent will allow admin staff to continue to ensure that after you leave at night that your offices will be clean and that the buildings and grounds will be welcoming for your constituents again tomorrow. They will complete routine repairs and maintain the vital public space on the Capitol grounds and help continue to bring clean energy to state buildings and avoid costs by reducing energy consumption and waste. The in lieu of rent appropriation has remained essentially flat since 2003. This operating budget adjustment request also reflects that worker staffing levels be reset to pre-restoration levels in the Capitol, that we make sure that we have the resources to perform recommended inspections that have been recommended by the contractor who completed the restoration work at the Capitol so that we can do what we need to do to better maintain and preserve the state's $310 million investment in that state asset. And there is substantial public space in the new restored Capitol, as well as much more robust mechanical systems that, frankly, either didn't exist or were decades beyond their useful life prior to restoration. Madam Chair and committee members, beyond maintaining an adequate base of funding for core services, the single most valuable beneficial improvement that we can make together in admin's operations is to invest in better, more secure, and intuitive technologies. That is why the governor recommends, and I strongly encourage you to support $10 million to begin funding for an e-procurement system that fully supports the procurement functions and needs of the state. My staff in the Office of Equity and Procurement has done a great job at streamlining and reforming our procurement programs to increase contracting with small businesses, including veteran, minority, and women-owned businesses, but we have a long way to go. And by the single most challenging hurdle that we have to ensuring robust competition for state contracts, which is essentially important to ensuring the best value for taxpayers, the single most important hurdle we have is that our outdated, cumbersome, and complicated systems that we operate. Essentially, vendors, purchasing agents, and Minnesotans, I would say, expect us to have the Amazon experience. Our service is more in line with a Montgomery Ward's mail order catalog. Montgomery Ward's is out of business, by the way. We purchase roughly $2.5 billion worth of goods and services annually. All steps in the procurement process, from requisition to solicitation through billing and analytics and data reporting. In order to achieve that, across state government and across state agencies, we operate 40 subsystems in order to make that happen, rather than a handful or a select group of uniform systems across state government. We maintain state contracts on paper. We essentially are not able to verify that we are always getting the low price due to manual reentry and the lack of checks and balances built into the procurement system. There's five key benefits that would come from implementing a modern e-procurement system. One is improved contract compliance and controlling maverick spend. And by maverick spend, what we mean is what you have to do right now is we put contracts in place. If you are able to search and find the correct state contract to purchase off of, you call the vendor, get a quote for a product. Hopefully the vendor gives you the correct and negotiated low price that we've negotiated, and then you manually enter that price that you're going to pay for the product into the accounting system. If you happen to enter the wrong price, there's no check or balance in the system to make sure you're actually getting the negotiated low price that we've set. Another area of benefits would certainly be transactional benefits by automating routed approval processes, reducing people time, minimizing manual entry errors, and building in verification steps. A third area of benefit would be lower contract prices by being better able to leverage volume purchasing. We would improve management information, resulting in more useful, more accurate data, greater transparency, and being able to anticipate and resolve problems more quickly. And we would improve payment mechanisms by benefiting the vendors who use our systems, especially small businesses who have less cash flow, and allowing the state to take better advantage of prompt payment discounts. All of these changes would make the state a better business partner with our vendors. With additional funding, we would ultimately deploy a modern electronic marketplace, creating an intuitive self-service shopping option for agencies and local governments that would greatly improve the overall procurement effort and would be more like an Amazon experience. Finally, Madam Chair and members, the fourth recommendation is funding to support the 2020 census. The 2020 census is nearly upon us. Work by the experts who do that at the federal and state level is already underway. Traditionally, the Department of Administration has received an additional appropriation to provide access to help ensure access to Minnesota-specific data sources and technical assistance to the Census Bureau. We have heard that Washington is not currently funding the census request at the desired level, which makes it all the more important, I believe, for Minnesota to make sure, relative to other states, we do everything that we possibly can to maximize our count. You all, I'm sure, are aware, but we have a number of important things on the line that are contingent upon our census count. One is retaining our congressional representation at the current levels. A second is, of course, that there is about $40 billion of federal money that is distributed based on census data each year. The governor's recommendations, Madam Chair and members, are prudent and focus on the priority needs of my agency, for which additional resources are needed in order to meet the needs and expectations of Minnesotans. I strongly encourage you to fund the governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Administration, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Vogel.
Madam Chair. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear properly. Madam Chair, for the testifier, you're saying that you're going to eliminate 40 of the subsystems. I'm curious if you have some $10 million, a lot of money to just kind of start with, and I'm wondering, do you have some type of goal or what you're going to get to, what it looks like when you're done? I realize it's a process, but you know, when you lay out the money, it seems to be out there, and then if in a few years it isn't really working, I'm just curious what we're kind of headed toward.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, I appreciate the question. Just to put in context, I want to start with remembering that we buy about $2.5 billion worth of goods and services a year. So even a fraction of that, 1%, is $25 million. So the $10 million, yes, a lot of money, but in context, it's really important to have an effective system in place. We have worked, we're not flying blind. We have engaged a company called North Highland, which is does a lot of work in this space, as well as a firm, Civic Initiatives, that has done robust, is in the process of completing and has provided us a robust assessment of our current system, both by going to talk to vendors, going to talk state agencies, going to talk to local governments that use the system in order to identify what the needs are and what the opportunities for improvements are, as well as reaching out and understanding what is the technology that's used in other states, used in the private sector, and making sure that we are moving forward in the right direction.
Representative Vogel.
Madam Chair. And I recognize the thought of the efficiency that can be gained relative to the large amount of money that you're doing. I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, how we're going to get there along the way, and knowing that it's making the progress it should, you know, what is it? And I realize it's difficult to say what the vision is when you're done. And I'm thinking of something like Minsure, where it was this large thing that started and was supposed to work, and then we spent all of the money and it kept getting funded and funded along the way. Obviously, if $10 million was able to save 1 or 2% of that large amount each year, money well invested. But I guess I'm just curious how, what kind of controls and what kind of accountabilities and goals along the way might be put in place to make sure that by the time the $10 million is spent, that actually it is indeed saving the whatever you're projecting that hopefully it'll save.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Vogel, I certainly appreciate the desire and the expectation that you want to have goals in place and you want to make sure you meet milestones and you don't go off course. Again, I would say that we're not shooting in the dark with this system. We've done a lot of work understanding what is available, what the available technologies are, how they're already being deployed in other states. So I think we're not going to be breaking new ground. And unfortunately, I kind of wish we were breaking new ground because then we'd be ahead rather than behind the game. But we're not going to be breaking any new ground here in terms of putting in place a procurement system that really does a better job of assisting and coordinating both from right from the very beginning of a requisition all the way through to solicitation and payment. Right now, that is part of where there's many systems that you have to, that different IT systems that are and software systems that are used to facilitate the work that has to happen along that continuum rather than it being consistent in one data system that would allow us to do better data analytics, would allow us to automate a lot of processes that are now manual, to put verifications into the system in order to make sure that we're getting the maximum low price, that we're taking advantage of any volume discounts that we have an opportunity to do with our vendors.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you already have an idea then of the software or the system that you're going to use? Is it kind of a, I wouldn't say off the shelf for $10 million, but is, you know, as you talk about this, and theoretically I agree with you totally, but I'm just curious, you know, we're looking at spending $10 million in a one-year period, what I'm seeing here in fiscal year 2018. So it looks like it's fairly imminent, and I'm just curious where you're headed with it. I'm glad you've done some research, but what is the research pointing toward relative to the expenditure of the money?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative. So we have, and I should be clear because I want to be transparent, that $10 million, there would be ongoing costs. $10 million is not the full cost. We have worked with North Highland to come up with a potential sequence of the functional needs that we have so that we could prioritize those functional needs, probably starting with requisitioning system and eventually getting to a full kind of Amazon-like marketplace, but and then management reporting and that sort of thing afterwards. So there are ways for us to break down the work effort in order to make sure that we're using the resources smartly and getting productivity and getting functionality as we move along the course to a complete system.
Well, just, Madam Chair, one more then. Maybe if you could just, and obviously you don't have it wrong today, but if you could just share the budget of how the $10 million is going to be spent, I guess maybe that would answer my question so that I can see the path of, you know, how did you come up with the 10 and how is it going to be spent, because it is, like I said, a relatively short period of time, so I'd anticipate that you already, if you got that,
go ahead. Happy to get you more specific information on that, Representative.
Thank you.
And just to follow up on that, so what is the anticipated cost savings that you would achieve by spending this upfront $10 million and then the ongoing amount?
Madam Chair, I do not have a cost estimate of that. I would say a couple things. One is, you know, again, going back to the $2.5 billion of goods and services we buy each year, the other thing is, as you all know, I think that is not built into agency budgets is inflation. So one of the things is that we don't, I think agencies anticipate and expect and very much hope that the Department of Administration will be able to continue to help them find efficiencies in pricing just to kind of keep making ends meet from year to year without that being built into the base budgets. We do, in answer to your question, are at the point where we are looking at the systems that have been deployed in other states to try to learn more about what their experience has been in terms of savings. But I don't have an estimate for you at this time.
Okay. Representative Nash?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this wasn't going to be a question, but piggybacking off of Representative Vogel, the software for $10 million, you're working with Minute on that? Going to hope yes?
Representative Nash, absolutely, yes. We work with, and it's not just, it should be clear, it's not, and this I'll itemize it for, we'll be able to itemize something for Representative Vogel, but it's not just software, so it would be a combination of software. Obviously, in order to deploy a system, there needs to be some staff on hand during the point of doing the programming and integrating the system. So there would be both consultant staff who are familiar with the product, as well as there would have to be staff resources who are familiar with the state's procurement system that are dedicated to that project to deploying it. So it's a combination of temporary staff costs as well as software costs and hardware costs that would go into the overall product.
Representative.
And Madam Chair, Commissioner, you're putting new software in, and you've got a list of things that you're going to be decommissioning as well, right? And the savings that we're going to accrue with that is somewhere for us?
Commissioner?
Because when you stand software up that's doing a job, you're going to ostensibly stand software doing a similar job down.
We would certainly hope to replace some of the subsystems that are currently operate across state government.
Madam Chair. Commissioner, I got to think that you've already sort of, at least on a cocktail napkin or a legal pad, you've done some of that work, or maybe Minute has. You've done some of those things, as Commissioner.
We are
Commissioner,
Representative, Madam Chair, and Representative Nash. We still have some more work to do in that area, but it really depends on how we sequence. The new functionality that we would put in place, because those 40 subsystems don't all do the same thing, so we would obviously be able to hopefully replace some of them, but not all of them, as we moved along the path to a full integrated system.
Representative Ann?
And Madam Chair, Commissioner, maybe you can work with Minute, because I'd like to see what it's going to do. I always like the shiny new software and the shiny new tech. I'm that guy. But, like I said, in every business I've ever worked in, any business anywhere, if you stand new technology up to do jobs, even jobs that might be, some jobs may be new, other stuff is currently being done, and there has to be something you can stand down. So if you wouldn't mind helping us out with that. But I do have some other questions for you, and Madam Chair. Commissioner, you talk about your increase in fuel costs. I'm really curious, how do you, because I don't know, not a gotcha question, but how do you acquire fuel? Because I know there's places like the St. Cloud Fuel Bank. Do you make bulk purchases at a set price for fuel, or how do you handle that over the course of the year?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Nash, we, like everything that we purchase, we have an established state procurement process that's laid out in statute, so we we purchase on a bulk contract. I don't, so it really, probably our different agencies do it differently. I would anticipate that DNR and DOT purchases off that contract for some bulk purchases, but what we do is we solicit for a bulk purchase contract for fuel at as low as prices we can possibly get.
Representative.
And Madam Chair, so Commissioner, is that done quarterly, monthly, yearly, so you set your price up front and you play it, and they
believe
an arbitrage that happens, or how is that done?
Yeah, I believe the fuel contract is annual. A lot of our contracts, if you were to look at across the thousands of contracts, contracts are a maximum of 5 years unless there's a exception. Most contracts are 2 years, but it really depends on the market that we're in, and that's an annual contract.
Madam Chair, and I know that fuel is kind of a volatile thing, so it's tough. Certainly, I would love to lock in a five-year price. You can't always. Sometimes you might lose, but
if we lock in at the right five-year price.
Yeah. Well, Commissioner, could you get us maybe a historical fuel spend, just because we all love numbers here. That's why we're on State GovFi, just to kind of analyze what fuel costs have done. And then just because I'm wondering, and maybe I'm the only one, but wondering how is that price that you've gotten versus the spot price for what all of us would pay at the pump, just to kind of make sure that we're managing that well.
Sure, we can pull that together for you.
Commissioner?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you. On your sheet, you also talk about, I think it's page 2, that you've got roughly $300,000 each year to reset capital labor staffing to pre-restoration. I'm hoping that's going to go down now that or did it go down during restoration? Did it go up during restoration?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Nash, what that refers to, it certainly was down during restoration. We didn't have people cleaning the place during restoration, but prior to restoration, it was also down prior to restoration. So this is to reset staffing levels to what is needed to maintain the space as it was. I don't know exactly the year, but it's probably, if we started the restoration in 2012, 2013, it's probably to reset to like 2011 levels.
Okay. Representative Ann.
Okay. Thank you. Last question, and I've asked you this in years past, but you manage grants for other agencies. And if I remember, gosh, I want to think it was 2015, you told us in committee that there's like a 3% maximum grant peel-off that you all have. What is the total number of grant dollars that you have through your organization? What is that dollar amount? Because I'm just trying to figure out, obviously, these individual agencies are fighting for grants, and mm-hmm. we want them to get as much as they possibly can. And I'm just wondering, you know, how many people are doing this work? What is the total peel off, and I'm still curious. I've never quite gotten over that because I don't know sure. that I've ever gotten quite to the bottom of it.
Commissioner?
Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I'm glad you asked the question because it gives an opportunity to clarify, and actually this is one area that I would say I'm not asking for resources where I think a legitimate case could be made for some additional resources. As I mentioned at the beginning, we get roughly $11 million a year that's passed through money from the general fund. I think probably five of that, roughly, is for grants to public broadcasting. We get no money to administer those general fund grants, actually. The 3% that you're referring to, which is actually an amount up to, we are only able to take some portion of the grant monies from the grants that are funded from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. So actually, we do a lot of work to administer public broadcasting grants from the general fund, for which we get no administrative resources at all. The other thing that I would clarify is in reference to the work with other agencies, because the Department of Administration is home to the Office of Grants Management, I just want to be clear that is not the work that we do with other agencies in the Office of Grants Management, which essentially only amounts to about a person and a half, is more of a policy setting and guide best practices setting function that puts in place best practices to help direct how other agencies and how the enterprise administers grants and grant policies. So that's more of a policy-making, guideline-setting functionality, but we don't actually administer any of the grants. Obviously, a lot of other agencies administer grants directly under those policies.
Representative
Nash? Did that help in any way?
Maybe we should meet my office one time so I can kind of get sure. to the bottom of that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Just to back up on a couple of the items on the capital restoration and wanting to beef up the maintenance staff there, when we went through the process of the capital restoration, did you leave some positions open in other areas and then shifted that staff to those places? Or where did the staff go during the restoration process? Because I'm assuming you didn't lay them off.
Madam Chair, we have – that's actually an area of our staff where we have a reasonably high turnover rate. So it was – we didn't obviously need those positions during the, so we didn't lay anybody off. We did move people to, if they were, we either moved people to other locations and through attrition, we didn't have the positions for cleaning the space.
So why would you need additional positions when you've already gotten that budgeted? I mean, it's, you know, part of the capital anyway. Why would you need additional funds because you've already gotten those FTEs baked into the base?
And so actually they're not baked into the base, Madam Chair. In 2000, as a result of, so coming off the last decade of budget cuts and lean budgets in 2011, I believe it was, we eliminated a total of 20 positions in our maintenance staff across the Capitol complex, many of which were positions in the Capitol itself. And so I think that those positions are, bringing those positions back are, is very important to making sure that with the public space, with the newly restored space, that we can maintain it at an adequate level.
And Commissioner, how many FTEs did you add over the 2013-2014? Biennium.
I've not, so add where? Sorry, in maintenance staff?
Just overall.
Or overall?
Yeah.
I don't have, I know that we provided you that information in the letter response. I don't have it all in front of me right now.
Okay, you can get back to me on that. I do want to ask more, too, on the $10 million for the e-procurement system. If you haven't identified that this is going to be a cost savings from that perspective, why would we, you know, what is, it's got to have some cost savings to it. And I can't imagine that that hasn't been part of the conversation at all and what that would be. Because I'm assuming if you're going to go to an e-procurement system, as you've described it, it's meant to make things more efficient. So you would have some cost savings, both from a staffing perspective as well as just general operational finance standpoint, mm-hmm. too. So can you get us those numbers?
I can. And what I would add to that, though, is, you know, I think an important thing in terms of talking about improvements and efficiencies is also to recognize that much like if you were investing in a product line in the private sector, there's always also an expectation of value and improved service. So some of the investment is going to reflect in having a better system for our vendors. So take, for example, that we have staff that oftentimes have to spend much of their day being on the phone with vendors, helping them navigate the complexity of the current website and the current registration system just to register so that they can potentially bid on state contracts. So this system, vendors shouldn't have to do that. Vendors should be able to go online, go to the website, find it an intuitive system, and have a higher value system that enables them to self-initiate without a lot of questions and complexity, both the registration process so that they can identify themselves as a potential vendor with us as well as submitting their responses to contracts as well, contract bids.
Okay. And then last before, and I know Representative Johnson has some questions too, but I did want to ask you too, on the lease information, mm-hmm. so the different agencies are all paying more. Can you talk to me about that? And I see the document that you provided to us, but can you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, Madam Chair, there's some important history there. The agencies are paying an average of about 3.4% more across the agencies. It varies building by building. There was, again, during an important part of this is during the lean times of the last decade, there was an effort to keep rates from going up across the campus, and so to have a net zero. So what that meant is if some building was costly to administer, the rates for one building might have gone up and they might have been forced to be artificially lowered in another building. So what I inherited was a situation where the rates for individual buildings did not actually reflect what the costs for those buildings are. So we have been going through a process of putting in place a more appropriate business practice where we're looking at individual buildings, the costs associated with individual buildings, the debt service, the maintenance needs of individual buildings, and setting rates that reflect what is going on in individual buildings. And as a result, some rates are going down, some rates are going up, and the average increase is 3.4% across the campus.
Commissioner, which ones are going down? Can you just give me one?
I don't actually know that any are going down from 17-18 to 18-19. I know that they have been in prior years, so I can get you that information. I don't believe any are going down from in the period from 17-18 to 18-19.
Okay. We should.
But they are going up by different amounts. So some are above the 3.4%, some are below the 3.4%.
I think you and I should probably meet on this and just talk about this a little bit more. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Mossman, one of the things that obviously we get paid a lot of attention to is that $10 million one-time increase for the e-procurement system. I guess I'm trying to get a feeling for wants versus needs on this. I could see where it would be a nice thing to have, but how necessary is it really? And is it the kind of thing that private corporations have in their operations and systems, or is it used in other states? I'm just trying to get a feel for the context of this request and its importance.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I'm glad you asked the question, because the reason this is the number one priority for me is because if I was to identify one thing in my time as commissioner that I could put in place that would leave the state and the agencies and the administration of them in better place that's within my portfolio, it would be to put an e-procurement system in place that modernizes the way that we do purchasing across state government. So with regard to other states and businesses, the answer is yes. Other states are ahead of us in terms of having more robust procurement systems. And certainly I don't think that you would go to a Fortune 500 company and see nearly the amount of hard paper that is part of the procurement process as you have with the state of Minnesota.
Representative Johnson.
I think I guess I can understand what you're saying. I mean, we like to complain, or a lot of people like to complain about inefficiency of the government and how we're not providing the services necessary, and I think even the speaker's looking at some initiatives to make the government services more efficient and effective. So I guess as I hear you speak and as I think about relative to other organizations, it seems like something that could really move the state forward in a long-term investment kind of way. It looks like you have someone.
I believe that's right. And, Madam Chair, if I could, Assistant Commissioner Alice Roberts Davis has both the public and the private sector experience to talk to us about.
Excellent.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Alice Roberts Davis, and I had the opportunity about 3 or 4 years ago to set up a similar system with Target Corporation, and it is absolutely almost an imperative in the private sector to have some sort of e-procurement system that will take you from procure to pay, the whole life cycle of the contract, because of the things that Commissioner Mossman mentioned earlier, just the efficiency, the ability to track any maverick spend to ensure that we're getting the lowest prices and to leverage our buying power as a state.
And Representative Johnson?
No, thank you very much.
And Ms. Davis, so then did you see the cost savings when you were
I actually, unfortunately, Madam Chair, did not stay with Target long enough to see the cost savings and to be able to quantify that for you here today. But just understanding from my perspective outside of the business and talking to people who are still there, they have been able to realize a lot of efficiencies and also are very happy that they went in that direction with a full catalog portfolio for purchasing.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You touched on the leases, and, you know, as I go through here on page 26 of the document that you gave us, note of that, the ones that are more expensive are the ones with debt service, which would make sense, running anywhere from $30 to $35 up to almost, well, just 10 cents under $50 for the new Senate office building. So when we're making our comparisons and assuming that most of the other properties that we're comparing to relative to the cost of operating generally is in that 18 to 22, probably net of taxes, I understand that they're probably paying $5 to $7 a square foot for taxes, but none of them more than 30. What I'm wondering is if a lot of these others, if they had similar debt to the private sector, if indeed that would be driving the price of that rent up. And what I'm getting at here is if we're operating as efficiently as we can, because if we're getting rent estimates or, you know, whatever we call this, of $16 to $25 without any debt service, and the private sector is renting the same with debt service, are we spending more on operations and so forth in the private sector? I'm wondering if you looked at that or do you understand what I'm getting at?
I think so. Madam Chair and Representative Vogel, we keep pretty close tabs and actually have our own pretty broad set of comparison points because we both obviously own property in St. Paul and we also lease quite a bit of property in downtown St. Paul for state agencies such as Deed, Housing Finance, a number of other agencies that are in downtown St. Paul in lease space. So we have obviously it's a cost and quality comparison. I believe, do compare pretty favorably. A number of the rates on here where you see in state buildings where it's quite a bit higher does have to do with the debt, not only the debt service, but the way the debt we went about the debt service for those buildings. There, I believe, in the case of Freeman and some others, there are appropriation bond situations. So they're not general obligation bonds. So there's just a little bit difference in the financing structure and the way we put that in place and built it into the lease rates.
Representative Vogel.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, what I was gathering there is if we look at page 13. I'm just doing an average in my head, you know, and I realize every building is different, but we're looking probably at $20. And if you add $5 to $7 on each one of those for taxes, we should be in the same comparison range. But then when we get to the other page, even on those older buildings, you know, we've got 31, 36, and then, of course, in the Senate office building at 49. And, again, looking at some gauge of efficiency. In other words, if our cost of operating those buildings are higher relative to what they're doing here, because I'm assuming that in the rates on page 13 that you're including the CAM, just not the taxes. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, you're obviously correct. There's the difference between owing property taxes and not owing property taxes. So what this reflects is, in terms of the state-owned building, it's a reflection of our cost of operation. So maintenance, janitorial services, occasional repairs, modest asset preservation, so occasionally looking at the windows or does there need to be some tuck pointing or something, but as well as debt service and what those costs are on a building-by-building basis. So there are some older buildings that have higher costs as they fall into disrepair than some newer buildings, and we do try and reflect that in the rate. We also have a depreciation built into the rates also. Now, the other thing that I would say is, you know, just for example, the Senate office building, the other thing that's important is, obviously, these buildings are not all the same thing, right? So some of them are garages or maintenance buildings. Some of them are strictly office buildings. A building like the state office building is not strictly an office building. It also has large hearing rooms and other things that add to the cost and the square footage costs that are, so it's a like the Capitol is also not an office building. So they're not, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of the functionality and the uses of the buildings either.
Representative.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe if you wouldn't mind when you're doing some follow-up, I could chat with you and we could do that at the same time if I have further questions.
Yeah, I think that would be very helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
Just out of curiosity, Commissioner, you mentioned that you built in the depreciation. Yes, my gosh. Heaven's sakes. It's a long day.
Happy to help.
Yes, thank you. So what would so I'm assuming that you're putting that set aside because you're thinking when you have replacement of it, correct?
Madam Chair, I'm gonna do a phone a friend yep. to the CFO if I could.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Micah Intermel, CFO with the Department of Administration. So, yes, when we collect the depreciation, 50% of it stays with the Department of Administration for facility repair and replacement costs, and then 50% goes back to MMB, to the general fund.
Okay. I've never seen us actually use the 50% repair and replacement towards buildings. Can you tell me where it goes?
Sure. Madam Chair, we certainly do use it. I think the important thing is that there's a difference between eventually systems get beyond their useful life. So it's not the amount we set aside is not nearly the – it's not a replacement value concept. So we – put aside, so we use the facilities repair and replacement account for things like I think some of the recent projects are upgrading the fire security systems in some buildings so that the technology fits with what the fire department needs and the systems, those systems will work functionally well. Or it could be repairs to leaking windows or a roof that is leaking or something like that. But eventually buildings like this building, the Centennial Office Building, some others, just age out and need total refurbishment. And so it doesn't, it's not intended to be a sinking fund at that level.
Commissioner, how much do we have in the R&R account?
Madam Chair and members, I would have to check. I believe it's $11 million.
Okay. All right. That's it for me. Anybody else? Representative Lilly and then Representative Green. Representative Lilly, you first. Unless you want Representative Green first, then you can clarify.
Okay. Madam Chair, I don't need wrapping up comments or anything. Madam Chair and Commissioner, I just want to thank you on the Capitol, just how great that's turned out. It's really quite a neat project. The only problem I've noticed, though, in the tunnel, I saw Representative Quam kind of going around and around and around. He couldn't quite figure out where the tunnel was, but maybe he could put some directional markers for the people from Rochester area. But, no, it really has turned out great, and people, just the comments have been top-notch on the Capitol and how they've really loved the how that's turned out, and seems like it was on time, on budget, everything, but I guess I haven't.
Yes, to both of those.
Okay,
thank
good.
You.
So I have a question. You know, a lot of times we hear up here to run things like a business, and I hadn't even thought about fuel and all those things, but I know a Minnesota company that bought a refinery. They use a lot of fuel, and I wonder if you've considered buying a refinery to answer some of Representative Nash's questions, because maybe you could buy down your cost if you wanted to buy a refinery, because I know it worked for a
company that I'm familiar with. And it's not that far of a stretch, actually, in a way. You know, a lot of municipalities have liquor stores and power companies, municipal power. But anyways, I just wanted to throw that out. I imagine the answer is no, but I do know we're often encouraged to run things like a business, and some businesses do buy their own power.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. We are a large employer. I don't think we buy that much fuel to own a refinery. And if I'm going to run a refinery, I would like to be paid to run a refinery.
All right. Members? Nope. Representative Green? Nope. All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I think it would be good to see the R&R kind of past 3 years, maybe, how it's been used. I think that would be helpful, too.
Yep.
With that, members, we are adjourned.